Welcome to Guest in the Homes, where we interview scholars and those with connections to the homes to gain insight into the Klein family and the historical context of the homes. I'm Karen Thalacker.
I'm Andrew Newell. Thank you for joining us for Guest in the Homes.
It is with great pleasure that I introduce our guest today. Her name is Kobe Budridge, and back in 2019, Kobe and I connected through an archivist from the Lutheran Church. I had contacted the archivist seeking information about the homes. The archivist said she had no information except for some blueprints she found in a drawer. A month or so after I contacted her, Kobe contacted the same archivist asking about the Muscatine Orphanage. The archivist told Kobe that she didn't know anything about the orphanage in Muscatine, but she knew someone who did. And that's how Kobe and I began exchanging emails. In the beginning, we had one thing in common. We both wanted information about the homes. But now, we feel like family, and I am so happy to have her here with us today. Welcome to the podcast, Kobe.
Thanks for having me.
So our listeners are familiar with my mother and I's connection to the homes, that Reverend and Mrs. Klein were my great-great-grandparents and my mom's great-grandparents. So your family's connection comes from a different side of the process of the homes, so to speak. Your father, Jerry, and your Aunt Betty were actually children who lived in the orphan's home back in 1937, even though both of their parents, John and Selma, were still alive. Your dad was 4 at the time, and your Aunt Betty was 9 and a half. And you had no idea about your connection to Muscatine until 2018 when you asked your Aunt Betty, who is in her 90s now, about some photos. We would love to hear how you heard about the homes in Muscatine.
You're correct. Aunt Betty is 94 now. Both of my parents have passed. And Auntie Momsy, as I call her, and I are very close. We speak at least every other day. And at one point in time, I was kind of musing with her over the fact that despite the fact, that we have literally hundreds of family photos archived here, I couldn't find a single one of either Aunt Betty nor my dad or the family, really, as kids. It was there were a couple that began to pop up about high school age, but it was as if they almost didn't exist prior. And when I mentioned it to Aunt Betty and asked if she had any, she went silent for a moment and I said, I'm going to tell you something that nobody else knows. Your dad and I, were in what she termed an orphanage as kids. And it's a period of her life that she had never spoken about to anybody prior. I never heard a word about it from my dad nor my mother. I suspect my mom didn't even know. There were, unfortunately, some hard times going on at home, as you mentioned. My grandma and grandpa, their parents were still living, but they felt it was best at that period of time to have Dad and Aunt Betty go to what I later found out was Muscatine. The issue was that Aunt Betty did not recall much of anything about it. It apparently had been so traumatic, per se, that she had kind of blanked things out. The only tip she could give me was Iowa. And the second tip she gave me was that she remembered they used to summer in Muscatine. So that's really all I had to go by and started doing my research and found the Muscatine homes. And as Karen has mentioned, that's when I took a long shot and gave them a call and did get hooked up with the archivist there, who, again, did not have any information. I was told I could come look through some cardboard boxes in a basement that might have a couple things. But that's when it came to mind for her that actually there was one other gal out there who was seeking information, and that was Karen. So she did give me her contact info, pardon me, and she was as gracious as could be. And we did begin talking, and ever since I have had the opportunity via Karen to learn a tremendous amount about what actually happened. And
It felt like we were sort of solving a mystery together.
Very much so. Every little tidbit, every little piece that fit together, we went through a lot trying to figure out exactly when they were there and so forth. And again, thanks to much of your hard work, every little bit that pulled together has been one of the most, the things I've most appreciated about all of it. Three, actually. Aunt Betty has learned some things that make her feel much more whole as a person, even at her age, again, after how many years of not being allowed to discuss this with anyone. She was able to fit enough pieces together that she wants anyways to understand more about her experience. And for me, it's also been shocking, number one, because as I say, that nobody knew a thing, but through some of the stories and events and so forth that we've learned, it's brought me, even after my dad's death, a lot closer to him. I understand him a lot better now, and a lot of our family dynamics, because as you can imagine, it has a large impact on you as a kid if you're leave home and have to, as you say, go to a children's home. And in the meantime too, one of the nicest things, as you mentioned, is that throughout the process, our two families seem to have kind of blended. We consider you part of our family now, and I think you've mentioned vice versa. It's really neat to meet the generations after of a family that very obviously helped my family during a very difficult time. And your great-grands would have been there, I'm sure, on their intake as well as their discharge. So would imagine they even met at a time when Dad and Aunt Betty really could use some nurturing and some support, and it was your family that did that for them. So I feel forever grateful for them doing that. And it's really been a wonderful experience.
It has, and for us, as we've done this research, the experience of your dad and Aunt Betty and sort of some of the family dynamics that led some of the children to be at Muscatine really did expand our understanding of the importance of what they did there, but also the difficulty of what they did there and just how traumatized, again, the children must have been who kind of appeared on their doorstep. So let's go back to 1937, and you have John, who is your grandpa, and Selma, who is your grandma, so Betty and Jerry's parents. What was going on there? What have you learned about that? Why would the children have been sent to an orphanage if they weren't really orphans?
This is even more interesting, especially having heard other family stories and so forth. My grandfather, John, was a Chicago cop. And apparently during that era, not all policemen were on the up and up, shall we say. And Selma was a stay-at-home mom, and she became aware of some of the things that my grandfather was involved in. He was lived down the street from Al Capone, was involved in a lot of bootlegging and so forth during Prohibition. At any rate, she was so distressed by it that she tried to tell on him. And he used his influence to have her put into a mental institution instead, where she received everything from just short of shy of a lobotomy. She had the ice bath treatments, the electroshock treatment. At any rate, my grandfather's, my grandmother's actually, relatives were aware of the fact that the children, being my father and aunt, were at home alone, and that wasn't appropriate. So, and they had no idea when Selma was going to return. So apparently one of the folks involved in that group knew of Muscatine and helped facilitate getting them out there to stay for at least a bit until Grandpa John could come up with a better solution for the kids, whether it be getting poor Selma back home or finding somebody else to help take care of them.
It seems like they went to maybe a church in Chicago that had a pastor that had some connection to the Muscatine homes.
They did indeed. Yes, they were all, in fact, that's interesting. Their records, they were all baptized there. I wish I could, can't recall the name of the church right now.
I think it was St. Stephen's, maybe?
St. Stephen's, that's exactly right. Yes. And so they were highly involved there, and so were these other folks. And pastor there, I can't remember if you helped me find it or not, but there's a letter, even letters of that pastor, writing to the home to ask if they would take my dad and Betty, letters from my grandfather apologizing for being late for the $5 that he owed for the month, that kind of thing. So there was that tie there, though.
Yeah, and that was a really just eye-opening part of this, was about the records themselves, because the records of the children are sealed. And so, you know, what we had in the research were the newsletters, and then you can kind of use those as a springboard to start looking at other issues. But because Betty and your dad were not adopted, and because Betty was still alive, she could sign a release and get her own records. And so we were able to get a peek inside of what even the administration of the homes look like. And that was really an amazing experience to see just administratively how it was run, and that they kept every piece of paper involved with your dad and your aunt.
The newsletters that you mentioned, those were absolutely fascinating. That's where it seemed we did get, especially you, most of our initial tips that helped us winnow down the period of time. And as you mentioned, go from there. It was fortuitous that Betty is still with us, for many reasons. But as you mentioned again, she also was able to, yes, access her records, which was a treasure trove. That was kind of the treasure chest that we were able to open and find out so much more, and how much your family did for the homes as well as all the residents. And in fact, a large number of your family, it seems, were staff there.
Yes, off and on. I said it was like, different sides of the family would come there to work. And then, of course, they weren't related, but then they'd get married.
And so
it was quite a, it was like, I said, Little House on the Prairie and Downton Abbey and everything all mixed in one. The newsletters, we were able to find the newsletter, the messenger that announced the arrival of your dad and Aunt Betty. And, sometimes they actually named the children, but in this situation, they didn't. They just said two children were released to relatives, and two were accepted from Chicago.
Chicago, that's right.
And that was Aunt Betty and your dad.
That's it. Could only have been them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, the newsletters have been so interesting in so many ways, not only because of the information it led to about Dad and Aunt Betty, but once again, about all that your family and many others did to, it's not a, certainly not a pleasant experience to be put in a home per se, but they certainly went to every effort that they could to make sure that the kids were well taken care of and felt welcomed and supported. And that to me is a huge deal. As I say, it's difficult to even think about Betty and my dad having to have gone through it, but it's so comforting in a way to have known that your family would have been there to help them on their way.
So, Kobe, you characterized your Aunt Betty's experience as being rather traumatic, and it's pretty obvious that your mother being sent away to an institution and to be subjected to all sorts of things would be a deeply traumatic experience. What exactly did your Aunt Betty remember about the experience of going to the homes? Was there any trauma involved with that?
So much so that apparently she's literally kind of blacked it out. She to this day swears that she does not at all recall arriving, who brought them, et cetera, and so forth. With your mom's help, I've since discovered how that did happen. But she recalls nothing about the arrival. Very, very little about her time there, other than a senior resident passing away, and Aunt Betty had been apparently friends with her, and she was miffed because some other little girl was chosen to attend her funeral and got to borrow Aunt Betty's favorite brown velvet dress. So that, for some reason, stuck with her. But other than that, again, she had very little memory. Bits and pieces have started to come back. She was apparently separated by age and sex from Dad. But she recalls looking over a brick wall, for example, and seeing him playing down below and worrying a lot about him. He even came home. He's forever after in his life. He tied his shoes funny. And we finally figured out it's because he had to teach himself from looking down above rather than somebody teaching him. It's all these little things that kind of pop up. But again, she doesn't recall much of anything of being there. Although interestingly, when I showed her photographs, which Karen and I have also come across, it rang a bell immediately. In fact, even before she saw the photos, that was something she could remember, that there was a farm. She remembered a very large stairway heading up to the main building, that there was a cemetery there. So when we saw the photos and I was able to provide her with those, that was another interesting moment where things clicked more for her. As far as actually what happened there again, she to this day says again that it was just so awful that she, and then also having been told for how many years at age 94 that she's never to discuss it with anybody. There was, of course, a stigma about grandma being in a mental institution, as well as having the kids go to again, what Betty calls an orphanage, children's home. So this is something that has been buried with her for so many years. To repeat, I think she kind of effectively blocked a lot of it out, but she now knows that she was there. She didn't make it up. She knows how old she was. Little things that just help kind of, as I say again, piece together at least some of her life during that period of time. I regret tremendously that I'm not able to talk with my dad about it, because I can't imagine what it would be like to hear what he remembers. He's the kind of guy that I have a feeling, no matter what age he was, would have probably had some very clear memories of it. Aunt Betty does not, although, to repeat again, she just felt it was so traumatic that she had to let go of the memories. And I think probably remembers a little bit more than she admits right now, but just kind of doesn't want to go back to it.
Well, and it's my understanding from what was indicated in the file was that, you know, the children were there. And then at some point, John, your grandpa, brings Selma, his wife, home from the institution and declares her healed. And then the children come home. And then no one ever speaks of it again.
Well, actually, they did come home. Selma came back and Selma acted up again. Acted out by, as I've mentioned, trying to report her husband. And it was a vicious situation. And she was sent back again. And so the children at that point were deemed old enough to kind of manage themselves, at least in the hours between school and when Grandpa would get home. There was another gal that came in to help some. But they were left without their mom still for quite some time. Apparently, after about 4 years, Selma decided she'd had enough and had earned grounds privileges and went out and walked out and climbed on a bus and went home. So the next thing the kids knew, Dad and Aunt Betty, was that they opened the door and there's their mother after all these years. And again, it was deeply ingrained that this would, again, never, ever be spoken of. And so it wasn't. But that would have been an interesting experience for them too, to say the least, I'm sure, as they had been told that their mother had left and wasn't coming back of her own volition. So, Selma had other ideas.
Was Selma from Germany?
She was. In fact, she came over at age, I believe, 16. I can't recall the name of the ship now, but she did emigrate and came over and landed in Chicago to live with one of the families that I believe was involved with the mending up at Muscatine. She stayed with them as a nanny. And again, in Chicago, where my grandfather also was, and they met at a city fair. There was some kind of a large fairground nearby that was popular for the young folks to meet and greet, and that's where Grandma and Grandpa met, kind of went from there. But yeah, she ended up with one of the families that knew the family that ended up suggesting they go to Muscatine. They all went to the same church, St. Stephen's.
So I think one of the most compelling parts of these records was a letter that your Aunt Betty sent to your grandfather asking to come home. Would you like to tell our listeners about that?
I would that other than it was very poignant, it to me it showed that obviously she had held a great desire to come home.
That it was must have been just horribly confusing to her. And then, you know, you're plucked out of your home in Chicago without notice, presumably, and then sent to this orphanage where you're living with 100 other children. And I wondered, did Aunt Betty, when she went to Muscatine, did she speak German? Because there was a lot of German still being spoken at the homes.
Absolutely, yeah. Grandma was actually more comfortable speaking German than English, even throughout the years that I knew her, Selma. Now, Betty, my father, spoke German. Whether Betty does or not, that's a good question. I never have heard her speak in German, whereas my father used to lapse into it, especially if he didn't want me to know what he was saying.
I would think, though, that for children who ended up there, and of course nobody would plan to end up there, they would just have to go there. You know, even just having a language barrier would be difficult, but then also, you know, Betty would have been of the age where she would have had to pitch in and help a little bit. Your dad would have been young enough that he would have gotten to play and do some of those things. But Betty at, you know, 9 or 10, you know, might have had to do some chores there.
I suspect so. She would have been in that age group where they did expect them to help with housekeeping. They were each assigned, I think, different vocations, shall you say, whether it be laundry or housekeeping or cooking and dishes and so forth. They were, in fact, expected to pull their weight, so to speak. And when at an age where most young girls would be at home playing, presumably doing chores and so forth, but she had to adapt quite a bit, I'm sure, and at her age especially. Certainly, I would imagine, missed her mom terribly. The relationships between all of them with Grandpa John were all strained. But she definitely missed her mom very, very much. And so you can only imagine that that must have been, as you say, especially with a different language being spoken quite a bit, new surroundings, dormitory situation, that kind of thing. It certainly must have been pretty scary.
Yeah, it brought home for us, you know, for our ancestors who were there, you know, how would you deal with children who had all different types of trauma while still maintaining a household for all of these children? One of the things that struck me was that on their file itself, you know, it was Betty's name, and then she was listed as number 547, and your dad was 548. To me, you know, that means that back in 1937, maybe that's how many children had, I don't know that for sure, but that's what I would assume, that maybe that's how many children had come through those doors. And it just reminded me that each of those children had their own special heartbreaking story.
There was a blog I found somewhere of some of the Muscatine kids, and the most poignant to me were mentions of one young man had written in his diary as a young guy about staring down the very, very long driveway that apparently pulled up to the main building, and how many kids would sit and stare out the window and just hope and pray that their parents would pull back up. Not all of them, I don't think, they were orphans, but had been given up for other reasons and so forth, but were most of them due to be adopted. In fact, there were other stories about how children would be on their best behavior and try and dress up as well as they could and so forth, in the great hopes that couples who came to visit looking for to adopt a child would choose them. So there was always that that stressor as well, I'm sure.
So you've mentioned earlier that, you know, your father would speak German if he was particularly trying to hide something. Were there indications, looking in hindsight, that there were parts of his past that he wasn't telling you about?
Oh, very much so. Very much so, yeah. Not only just the orphanage piece, which is big enough in itself, but again, my grandfather John was an alcoholic who was violent. The kids would miss school. He'd beat them so badly. This is all stuff that I have found out since this journey began, just by talking to Betty a little bit more. That she's a little bit more open about with me than Muscatine. Again, I think she remembers it more than Muscatine, but yeah, he was an unpleasant person, let's put it that way. He certainly had no compunction whatsoever against deeming his wife crazy enough that she deserved electroshock therapy and so forth. That was his way of getting rid of her.
You had suspicions that she had some family members or someone in her life who was sort of, I would say, butting heads with your Grandpa John and was trying to sort of defend Selma, and that they were trying to make contact with the children in Muscatine. But your grandpa wrote a letter to Reverend Klein saying, do not allow them to have contact with the children.
Exactly, very much so. There was that piece as well. It was her stepbrother or a brother who moved somehow. He and his wife, again, all involved with St. Stephen's Church, when Grandpa John sent her back the second time, they vehemently contested it. They also tried to report Grandpa John instead and kind of redeem Selma as not being crazy at all. That didn't go over real well with Grandpa John. And that is actually, I think, why the kids came back in between even, and he gave it another try at allowing, per se, Grandma Selma to come home. But when this brother and his wife started to speak out, that's when he went really livid and sent her back, and they were unable to get her back out.
So when she finally did come out, did they live, they lived together then as husband and wife until one of them died?
Astonishingly enough, the woman came back, woman being Selma, and agreed. She was so afraid of being sent back again and being separated from the kids that she did agree to sleep next to that man for the rest of both of their lives. He passed first, and to literally act like nothing had ever happened. Of course, if she had tried to, she knew what would probably happen to her. Somehow she swallowed all that. No clue, as I say, throughout my sisters and my experiences with them as grandparents, no clue that anything had ever been wrong between them, so to speak. How she pulled that off, I don't know, but she sure did.
So in finding these records, how has that affected the way that your family sees its history?
That's a really good question, Andy. Unfortunately, my sister and I are really the only ones left, per se, other than Aunt Betty. My sister and I are estranged even, and so she doesn't want to hear much about this. So to answer your question directly, it's not had that much effect on anybody but myself, but it has had a huge impact. To repeat, it has helped me understand my dad could be very difficult, to say the least. Now I understand a bit more why. Some of the habits and worldviews and so forth that he had are a lot better explained, never mind the shoelaces. For example, he was vehement that I be confirmed as a Lutheran as a teenager, which was odd because we were not churchgoers and I'd never set foot in a Lutheran church, but it must have been some kind of an homage on his part to his Lutheran history, and especially at Muscatine. So that's why I say I wish so much that Dad and or Mom were still here so that I could, we could all have the opportunity to, if they were up to it, to discuss everything that had happened and what an impact it did have on our own family dynamics later.
I think you were very brave to start this journey and, not know where it was going to end, really. Not that it's even ended at this point, but you know, some people just don't have a desire to look any deeper than that. And I suppose that's okay too. But for you, again, when we first started, you didn't know, when you hear that your father spent time in an orphanage, you think about, I don't know, Annie or something like that, some concept of an orphan, of an orphanage that you had. And, you know, you had to be brave enough to want to know more, you know, to know more about Selma being sent to an asylum, you know, more about alcoholism, you know, more about those things that sometimes can be pretty painful. And you don't have the chance to necessarily resolve those with the people who were involved in it. Thank God for Aunt Betty that, you know, she's been able to kind of work through some of these things with you.
That's, she's been a big piece of it. And, yeah, to be very frank with you again, my father and I had a very, very difficult relationship. And, so again, as you said, when I heard he'd been in an orphanage, my jaw literally dropped because it was like, ah, oh, well, that explains a lot. But yeah, at least even though he's not here to share it with me, it has helped me resolve a lot of my own feelings and questions. And I just never quite understood why we had such trouble getting along. And that combined, his history, now that I understand it, combined with a few other things that he had mentioned throughout our lifetime together, it all just really helps me again, if I dare say, forgive him for a lot of things, forgive myself for not responding well, shall we say, to some of the issues that we went through. I wish we had the chance to have been more open about it and incorporated into our growth together while we were both, you know, he was still alive. But even without that, it has proven, as I say, to be cathartic, and it just kind of helps pull my life together a little bit more, quite a bit more actually, which is a really good feeling in a way. There's disappointment to repeat because I didn't get a chance to use any of the information in a more timely manner. But again, it has helped me understand who I've turned out to be and why. By virtue of who my dad was and his experience.
Right. And we've talked about one of the things that I think that has bonded us, you and me, is that this whole journey, finding out more about the Holmes, has done that for me with my grandmother and my great grandparents, that I feel like there was sort of a little piece of me missing that I didn't even know was gone. And right. Now, once I learned about this, and again, learning about your family, again, I just cannot say strongly enough, helped so much to really sort of fill in the picture of what was going on there in a very personal way. And so I have so much gratitude to you for what you've given to our family.
I couldn't say enough about you as well, the same way. Again, I think our being able to share these little personal bits and pieces that go along not only with our family's stories, our ancestors, but for you and I as well. To, you know, as I say, you and Andy and Robbie and Peter, everybody, you all feel like very much like true family because, again, things that happened, our families shared it together way back when. And the journey that you and I have been going through in uncovering that and investigating it and kind of absorbing it all has made you feel very special to me, very much so. And I can't thank you enough for all the amazing work that you have done and still do to kind of help keep exploring all of this, because it's part of our history. You know, it's nice to share it with you.
Oh, well, yeah. It has been truly a labor of love. And thank you so much for joining us. You know, being on this journey with you, again, has made everything so much more meaningful. I am 100% sure that our ancestors, every single one of them, the good, the bad, and the otherwise, are star smiling knowing that the paths of our families have crossed again. So, Kobe?
We couldn't agree more with you. Yeah. I do picture my dad kind of chuckling and I'm sure that he and Selma both are relieved in their own ways. They've passed, but I have funny thoughts about how people kind of may still keep in touch with us even after they're gone. And yeah, no doubt about it, that they'd be just as thrilled and relieved, I think is another word that I would use, to know that this is where all this has led.
Well, we thank you so much for sharing the life of your family with us and being a part of this journey together. And we thank you so much for the time that you've given for our podcast.
Oh, Andy, I couldn't thank you guys more for including me. I appreciate it. Love you both very much.
Love you too, Kobe.